Okay, a deep breath. I got here late, so I've been running around. So these moments of taking a breath are really more for me than they are for you. Turn this around. I'll step on that. Okay, everybody, welcome back. This is session 5 of Buddhism in a Nutshell. This is our last night. Before we start, anybody here for the first time? It's okay. Welcome. Have you been to, so I have 2 questions for you. Number one, have you ever been to a Buddhist center before? First time. And are you a student with a class? Okay, because I always ask that because I get caught. And this is wonderful. The world religion classes are always coming in and the students are coming in and we just love it. But I have 4 kids. I know how this works. And they all have a paper that's due tomorrow. So I always like to make sure that I'm not going to run into that at the end of class where we have to do their assignment. So, just checking. Nope. Okay. Like I said, I love them to death. It's a good thing I had 4 kids, so I understand. This is the last of 5 classes, and we're going to kind of go into a pretty heavy subject, so I'm going to qualify some of this for those of you that are brand new, because this is a short 5-week course, and we cover a lot of concepts, a lot of history and a lot of concepts. The first probably maybe 2 up to 2.5 classes are very much just the historical stuff that you can pick up with just about any book or even Googling, okay? And then we start getting into concepts, and we just touch lightly on some major concepts. And the book, this book, Buddhism in a Nutshell, will cover everything that I covered in this class and then some. Okay, so again, any of you guys that have not had a chance to pick up this book yet, Venerable Amy Miller helped to write this book. She is a Buddhist nun that is phenomenal. I've been able to sit with her in teachings and learn from her. This book will cover so much more than we were able to in class, and it goes through things in a lot more depth. So if you have the opportunity, if you're interested at all, I really highly recommend that you pick up this book. Not only does it have it all there in writing so much better than the way I have explained everything, there is also a CD, okay? And that has audio of Venerable Amy teaching and also going through some of the meditations and stuff. And it's a very phenomenal, it's very soothing. She's got that voice, you know. So if you have questions, these are this book definitely. And then also, it's going to sound funny, but Buddhism for Dummies, man, is just a good kind of cut to the chase book for people who are just touching on this, okay? And that'll help to kind of get you up to speed, because we're going to, like I said, we're going to cover some topics that you don't have really the groundwork for, but dive in. It's okay. We've got a lot to get through tonight, so we're going to go ahead and get started. And we'll do a brief meditation and then maybe have time at the end. Again, I'll maybe give you some choices on what we do. But I want to do one that we haven't done yet. And again, my hope is to kind of introduce you to some of these meditations so that you can continue to try them, see what works for you, cherry pick through. I have my favorites. You guys will pick out yours. Sometimes it's not the ones you like to do. You may discover sometimes it's the ones you need to do. There's a big difference. But that's why cherry picking through and seeing what is actually helping, because that's the purpose of all of this. So I'm going to do another meditation tonight, and this one's called Mind Like the Ocean. We've done several different ones. We did Mind Like the Sky, and this is the same type of thing, just with using a different metaphor. And again, this is as much for me as it is for you, because I have been racing around, and then I get here and the door's locked and y'all are waiting and the sound's not here. Chris is always here. So I can feel myself kind of, so I like to use these for my own benefit just as much as for you. Okay. So if you remember, we have a 7-point meditation posture, and it's, let's all just get comfortable and bring our minds to the present. If you're sitting in a chair, sit a little bit forward in the chair so you're not leaning back. You're sitting on the ground. It's the same thing sometimes if you come a little bit to the front of the cushion. Basically, the 7-point meditation posture is, again, more for just giving yourself a stable place to meditate from than from anything else. This is this posture has been handed down for thousands of years, okay? And there's a reason that they have this posture, and it's basically very much a nothing holy about it. It's just about being comfortable and being able to hold a position for a long period of time. So your legs, either crisscrossed on the ground, whether lotus position or just crossed, half lotus, whatever's going to work for you right now. Your hands, in this tradition, we place our right hand on our left, touch the thumbs together, creates a little bit of a teardrop. We place our hands in our lap, thumbs slightly below the navel, and this brings our arms a little bit out from our body, allows air to circulate. We have our back straight, not stiff, but definitely straight. Shoulders are back. That helps our lungs open up and lets us breathe easier. Our neck and our head are slightly forward. I like to kind of pretend that there's a string that I can pull so that it stretches my neck, and that way it kind of elongates everything. Your eyes are slightly open, slightly closed if possible, staring maybe just a little bit unfocused in front of you by about 5 feet or so. And again, you're not closing your eyes and your head down so that you fall asleep when you're not up looking, because then you can get distracted. Your jaw and your mouth are not clenched, but slightly closed. Your tongue is on the roof of your mouth, just behind your teeth. Again, nothing holy about this. It's to help you so that you don't create a lot of saliva and need to swallow and have that distraction. So the 7-point posture and all of these other handouts are on the website. I'll walk you through that a little bit. But for now, let's just get comfortable. Come present. Focus your attention on your breathing and breathe naturally. Use one of the breathing meditations that we've learned in this class, counting the breaths, probably the main one, or bare attention, just breathing in and out through your nose and being aware of the breath. Settle your mind and bring it to a state of deeper focus and concentration, ready to engage in meditation. I'm going to set a motivation and create an altruistic motivation for this meditation session. Think that we're meditating not just for our own individual benefit, but we're taking the time now to meditate and develop our mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. Okay, so let's start by practicing bare attention. All that is just breathing in and out and being aware of the breath as it comes in and out through our nostrils. When you gain a deeper level of concentration and focus, loosen your concentration slightly and emphasize the element of mindfulness in your meditation a little bit more strongly. Allow your mind to be attentive and observant of whatever comes to notice, regardless of what it is. Don't identify with the mental elements arising. Simply observe them like a tourist. Allow them to rise as you observe them and pass away without getting involved. Just be aware. Allow your mindful attention to expand, to encompass your entire sphere of experience of consciousness. Forget that there is an observer and something being observed. Simply imagine your experience, your consciousness, as being just like the sky. Completely clear, vast, spacious, without end. Concentrate on this experience and identify with this experience. Calm, clear, spacious awareness. The mind can be likened to an ocean. Thoughts and other mental events to fish swimming through that clear, spacious medium. We're ordinarily unaware of the nature of the mind and instead observe only the fish-like thoughts. It's as though we are observing an aquarium through a large glass wall and at first only notice the fish. If someone were to tell us to observe the clear water in which the fish were swimming, we might have first even have difficulty noticing it because of its transparency. But by simply realizing that the fish could not be swimming unless there was some substance to swim in, we can take our attention away from observing the fish and focus instead on the clear water. In a similar fashion, we let go of paying attention to our fish-like thoughts. Instead, step back and recognize the clear, light nature of our mind within which all our thoughts and other mental events occur. Identify with our minds like an ocean with that clear spaciousness. In our ordinary state of mind, as we go about our business every day, having conversations, planning, thinking, worrying, making lists, and so on, it's as if we are living on the surface of that ocean. All those thoughts and feelings and ideas seem to fill our minds, making lots of waves, lots of turbulence and agitation. But as we identify more and more with our ocean-like mind and let go of the wave-like emotions and fish-like thoughts, it's as if we start to descend to the quiet depths of that ocean-like mind. And we reach a state of mind that is more peaceful, still, free of agitation and disturbance. In the case of the aquarium, we will continue to see the fish swimming in front of us as we focus on the water. However, when we focus our attention on the clear, light nature of the mind, our thoughts will begin to diminish in intensity and frequency, and thereby quieting the mind and enhancing our ability to concentrate. Whenever we identify with and are carried away uncontrollably by a thought, a feeling, we lose any awareness of the spacious clarity of our mind, of the vast, clear, and knowing nature of the mind within each thought or feeling occurs. Our perspective becomes small and constricted. It's as if all there are is the waves and we've lost the ocean. And we lose that open and quiet spaciousness. When we can simply observe these thoughts and feelings arising without getting involved, when we can identify with the ocean instead of the fish and the waves, then we can reside in that spacious purity of our basic clarity of mind. Calm, clear, peaceful, open spaciousness. Without agitation, without delusions, without anxiety and distress, without dissatisfaction and attachments and aversions. Calm, clear, peaceful, open spaciousness. Bring your awareness back to the room. And let's dedicate all that positive energy that we created through this practice of mindful meditation to becoming a better and better person who's more at peace in life and who can bring more peace and well-being to others in every moment of every day. I like that one. Okay. So, Did anybody remember to die last Friday morning? Let me get the mics. I think we're going to... Help me. What's that? Yeah, I've already got everything turned on. Okay, so who died? How did it work for you? Let me do a brief explanation to the people who are new. During this whole time of teaching, one of the things that we try to do is have a little bit more awareness of our thoughts. As we said, normally we go through life and we identify with the fish, and we don't think about the ocean and being. Our mind is like the ocean, all these thoughts. I like the fish that go there. So we kind of attach to these fish and we follow these thoughts. And living our lives and trying to have a little bit better awareness of what our thoughts are doing and what our mind is doing. And one of the things that we did last week is we talked about the preciousness of human life and how would you live your life and what would you do if you knew that you were going to die at the end of the day. Especially in our Western society, we don't think about the fact that everybody in this room is going to die. Everybody on this planet is going to die. And we don't think about it. We actually have a fear of it in Western society, so we don't talk about it. And it's completely opposite in Buddhism. We talk about it. Not only do we talk about it, we actually have meditation practices on it, because fear is really usually fear of the unknown. And since we know that we're going to go through this, and in Buddhism we believe in rebirth, it's better to get these things out. It's better to talk about them. And in actuality, Buddhists are some of the most joyful people I've ever met. And if you've had a chance to learn from Geshe-la at all and have any time with anybody that is a deep practitioner, honestly, I know we have suffering is what we talk about, but the opposite of that is happiness. And so I kind of try to focus on that. So we did a little practice, and we did a little bit of a thought, and I told everybody at the end of class last week, that when they woke up Friday morning, that as soon as they could think of it, think, I'm going to die at 6. And what would you do in that day if you thought that at 6 you were going to die? Now, you still have to go to work, okay, so we still have to pay the bills. We had some rules. But how different do you think about things? How much more special was that time with the people that you cared about? How much... You know, did you not pay attention to some of the little things that go on, and you know, everything was a little bit, to me, more precious. So here I'm telling you what you should be thinking. Who actually did it? Anybody actually? Could you share some of your experiences? I'm always curious as to.
I actually remembered right when I was getting coffee, like you said.
Right, you see, it's going to come at the weird time. That's right. I'm supposed to die today.
Yeah, and I called my family and everyone. I told them, you know, I wasn't going to kill myself. Actually,
Sandy's got me doing this silly exercise.
Yeah, and I got a great response. I got a lot of people, you know, I guess you don't tell, you say you love you every day, but you don't really
mean it.
Yeah. I did, however, tell two friends at work, and one of them wanted to eat herself, basically the sickness, all the food. She's like, I would eat this if I was going to die today. And the other one wanted to tell everyone how they felt about everyone.
Interesting, though, isn't it?
It is. It's interesting because I was like, well, I guess you haven't taken the class, so you,
yeah.
Your mind, you're thinking, I'm just going to blow all my money, you know, do all these crazy things. So,
okay, there is a kind of a progression, and again, this is part of that base that we're trying to draw from. So it's a progression. It's steps. You know, if you tell somebody out, you know, in the Western world mostly, you know, you're going to say, well, I'm not going to go to work today. You know, I'm going to go to the beach. I'm going to go to the mountains. I'm going to eat. I'm going to, you know, drink. I'm going to, you know, be depressed or whatever. So if you have the steps that we're going through, all of a sudden you felt a little maybe differently than they did.
Absolutely. And I kind of told them, like, what you're thinking is right, but that's not real. You know, it's not going to help.
So. Mm-hmm. So did it kind of make a difference for you during the day?
That was probably my favorite of all the practices we've done. That was my favorite.
Yeah, it's interesting to all of a sudden go through that. Anybody else?
No. I felt like I wasn't going to do anything differently than I would normally do. I wasn't going.
That
to
could be a good thing.
Yeah, it's. I mean,
everybody's different. So
everyone in my life knows exactly how I feel about them. You know, regardless if it's, you know, a good thing or a bad thing. But I just feel like I wouldn't have done anything different. I would have gone to work, not told anybody that this is going to happen, and just had it happen and just go along with my regular day.
So
yeah,
no.
It was in my head the whole time, like the whole day. And we even checked in, my friend Lisa here and I think it was at 6 o'clock. She's like, we didn't die.
I said, yay, rejoice. Yeah. We have another day to practice.
Yeah, so it was interesting. But just to be aware of it, and mm-hmm. I thought it was a good practice. And it really, you know, made me feel grounded in how I treat people and how I'm aware of others and what, you know, how my surroundings.
There it is, the practice. Okay, so that's exactly right. And what you said, that all of a sudden it was much more with feelings. Not more sincere, because when we tell our loved ones we love them, we mean it. We're just, you know, we're only half there. We're not totally present. And so all of a sudden when you do it now, it's that feeling, and that's a feeling, isn't it? So now that's experiential knowledge. That's experiential knowledge right there. What we're talking about. All of a sudden, she experienced the difference. So there's book learning, because we talked about it, so you can practice all these meditations and death meditations or whatever, and we try to bring up those feelings when we do these analytical meditations, and all of a sudden, so you now understand what I'm talking about, because you felt it, right? Experiential knowledge, okay? So it wasn't that you had to go out and do something. You worked with your mind to get this experiential knowledge. That's the practice, everybody. It really is that easy. You know, we just have to figure out how each of your minds are going to work. You have to figure out how each of your minds are going to work, because that's what we're doing. So if you can experience these things when you're meditating, then that helps you to get that experiential knowledge. You can understand dying without actually having to die. You can understand what that would do to your life. You can understand what precious human life really means, because you're thinking about it and you're trying to experience these things. So that's what I mean by when I'm saying experiential knowledge. Okay, anybody else? Right here.
I kind of remembered to do it, but it was kind of weird. So, because My thought was, you know, if I'm going to die today, I'm going to go do this, and this. And then, I don't know, it just clicked in kind of the next day, what I've been doing because of doing that. It kind of just didn't sink in, but what did sink in from it was, for the last 3 or 4 days, I've been declaring an intention for my day in the morning.
Okay.
And that has opened up a world of difference. Like, today was patience. Yesterday was help. Just real general stuff, and I was a lot more patient today.
Oh, because you're thinking about it.
Right, and when I stopped, like, waiting, I caught myself, because I said it. And, like, I woke up this morning, and I don't know what this means, but I woke up this morning, I said, should I be patient or listen today? And then I'm on my elliptical, and all of a sudden the song by Guns N' Roses comes on, Patience, and I go, okay, I guess that's the one. I'm not kidding.
You know, your mind is aware.
And then, I'll just say, I'm a recovering addict. I got 12 years clean, and I do a 10th step at night, which basically I review my day.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like dedicating.
Yep.
So it's really, that real, and that's what, and I've been doing that for 3 days, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it works. It seriously can work. Anybody else? Is anybody still doing the red light thing? I'm just curious. Yeah, it works. Isn't that funny? I've done it for years now. There's all kinds of those little things. So, well, I'm glad that everybody made it back. I've not lost a student yet from dying on this practice. You know, so.
Okay.
Yes.
I just want to say, I didn't do the practice, but I talked to an old girlfriend of mine that lives in Houston, and she called me, and she just had seen the oncologist. And she had bad news. She has been told she has 3 to 6 months to live. And so we started talking about all the stuff that she gets upset about. You know, she's going on about this. And says, you know, so we were able to talk about how precious this time is. And so I'll be involved with this. But it's pretty amazing when it gets that close.
When it gets that close. So two things. I have two things to say about that. First of all, I'm a cancer survivor. And I mentor people because that's what we do. Okay, somebody mentored me, somebody helped me through it, and you pay it forward. And so I've actually been with quite a few people. One young woman who passed away, and just different, you know, different experiences with different cancers. My husband was told he had 3 to 6 months to live. And now he's doing great. It was a mistake. So you have to, you know, I'm not saying, it's just you have to experience it and you have to go through it and you have to work with it because it's, you know, get all the preciousness, but, you know, hope is a very strong power too. So it's being real, but not giving up hope. It just can be a very different experience. I have another friend that was given 3 months to live, and he went through a very strong practice of things, very Christian-based, prostate cancer. Is that which is the really bad one? Is that it? Yeah. But he's 10 years now. So it's just can be different for everybody. So I'm sorry to hear about that, but I'm certainly very happy that your friend was able to talk to you about it. And these practices can make a huge difference to anybody with any faith. Because, again, you take some of the trappings off of it. It's all about working with your mind. So... okay, so we've talked about some of the history of Buddhism, the basic beliefs, concepts the last 4 weeks, and, you know, it kind of comes down to, you know, what's the point? Why are we doing this? And as Buddhists, the point for us is that it helps us. It makes us better people, happier people, and that's really the point for us as to why we do this type of practice. And you've gotten a little taste of it. And again, we're not about converting anybody. It's not proselytizing. We have people of all different faiths, all different cultures, all different ages, all different spiritualities that come here. My husband's Christian-based. I call him a Jibu because he follows the teachings of Jesus and of Buddha. And it all works. So it's just finding out what works for you. So if you find that this is working for you, you know, at the end of the class, we'll talk about some of the next steps that you can take. But the goal of what we're doing here is to develop the full potential of our minds, the full potential of the human mind to experience true and lasting happiness, and working specifically to eliminate the causes of suffering and fully developing our virtuous qualities. So that's basically kind of what we have done this entire time. And technically the term for that is enlightenment, or you'll hear the term Buddhahood as well. And some teachers, Venerable Rabina is one, I don't know if you've heard that name, we've got a lot of different teachers that come and visit and teach at the center too. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But she's a very strong, she's about 4 foot nothing, very strong personality, and she will tell you right here that there is nothing holy about any of the stuff. It is very practical. And this is, it works for anybody if you choose to work with it. So it is not about, you know, we tend to think about some of these things very abstractly. And anytime anybody says the word spiritual, you know, we tend to kind of put it off a little bit. And it's like, well, that's what's happened on church on Sunday, or that's what happens in my meditation room on the cushion. And it's like, that's not it. It's about taking it and working with it every day. So we use the cushion to work out so that we can practice it and out in the real world. And the same thing, you'll have many Christians, my husband being one of them, it's not about just what happens in church on Sunday, it's what happens, you know, Monday through Saturday as well. So that's we don't tend to think about it like that, and that's really where we try to go with this. It is very, very practical. We talked about the Dharma. Does anybody remember what that word meant? The teachings, okay, it is. We talk about it, yeah, we talk about Dharma in many ways. The teachings is one of them. The experiences that we have while we're going through these teachings, that's also the Dharma. We talk about the Dharma way of life. So Dharma is our actions, the things that we do. It is a Sanskrit word, means that which holds or protects us from suffering. And so it's also what we practice in everyday life. Lama Yeshe, the founder of this organization, the FPMT that we belong to, he's got a quote that says, "The Dharma is anything that causes our delusions and our disturbing thoughts to subside, anything that brings us peace of mind and liberation from confusion and suffering." So it's just as much what we do every day as what we do on Sundays and as what we do on the cushion every day. If we all got that message, the world would be a happier place. So we have all of these practices and all these teachings written out, right? We've got these books, we've got, you know, these classes, we've got all of these, you know, handouts and everything. So why aren't more people happy? Why aren't more people enlightened? You know, it's all here if we do it. One of the problems is that we are trying to use our minds to work on our minds. We are trying to use our minds to work on our minds. The analogy for that is you are a car mechanic trying to work on an engine of a car that's racing down I-40. Same thing. We're using the mind to work on the mind. So once you start to understand that, you're going to cut yourself a little slack. Okay? Because it's really hard to work on the mind with the mind. So anytime you start to get frustrated, think about it. I'm a car mechanic, and I'm sitting on the hood of a car that's racing down the freeway, and I'm trying to change the spark plugs. A little difficult. So that's one of the reasons that we kind of do things and practice the way we do. It's not just trying to read about things, but trying to have that experiential knowledge so that we can, you know, match our feelings to some of these things and have, again, a little bit of that experiential knowledge instead of just the book learning. Because that helps our minds to understand it. And it helps us to slow our minds down and helps us not to identify with the fish or the clouds. Our minds are that sky. Our minds are that depth of that ocean. And so, just having awareness is what's going to help us with that. And that's really why we practice. So again, we have that saying that a bird needs two wings to fly, and so does that bird of enlightenment. All right, the two wings are compassion and wisdom. And we've been talking a lot about compassion. Does anybody remember the Buddhist definition of compassion? We had a Buddhist definition that we hope that others not suffer. Okay? Love is that we hope others are happy, free from suffering. That we hope that others aren't suffering. That's compassion. And that goes to all beings, not just people. That we hope that any sentient being doesn't suffer. So we take it a step further and we talk about bodhicitta. So now we're down here. So we've talked about the Four Noble Truths and we're following this path. This is the first major teaching of the Buddha. And now we're on number four, the three aspects of the path. We talked a little bit about renunciation, and remember it meant that we weren't giving up everything that we like. It doesn't mean you have to go live in a hut someplace and give everything up. Renunciation is letting go of the attachment that we have for things. And again, I'm going to start skipping way over things, so you guys can slow me down or ask questions. But I want to get to some heavy things, heavy meaning another big concept. So renunciation does not mean that we give up all of our stuff. Renunciation means we give up having attachment to it. I'm at the restaurant, I'm done with my dinner, and I order chocolate cake, and I've got all my hopes and dreams on chocolate cake, and they bring me carrot cake. How upset am I going to be? Because I was so attached to having that chocolate. You know what? Carrot cake is okay. It's all good. Okay, so attachment. It's like magnifying the good, and aversion is magnifying the bad. So we spend all of our time running after the things that we want and things that we think we need, and we spend time running away from things that we don't like. So attachment and aversion are the two, like, you know, ends. And that middle way in between, kind of bring it back to that. So then we go into bodhicitta. Okay, we take it a step further and talk about bodhicitta. This is that third, the second of the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. And that's, anybody remember this one? Bodhicitta? The altruistic determination to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, to relieve their suffering and bring them to enlightenment. Okay, why bodhicitta? Why would we think that that's so important in this tradition? This is more the Mahayana tradition now. Why bodhicitta? Why is it important? Yes. So he's saying more than just ourselves, for all sentient beings. So how many parents do we have in here? Okay, it's okay. So as a parent, you know how you feel about your child. And you know that love, that you would do anything for them, right? Anything. Okay? And for those who aren't parents, if you have a loved one, your mother, your father, your pet. I mean, I've got three cats that are little fur kids. All right? The love that you feel that you would really want them to be happy. You'll do anything for them. You'll try to keep them from suffering, keep them from hurt. Some parent, I mean, we throw ourselves in front of a car. Anything. It's just what you do. So all of a sudden it takes you off of yourself, doesn't it? And as tired as you are at the end of the day from working and how sore you are or whatever, if your child needs something, it doesn't matter, does it? So it's that altruistic giving to somebody else. It is so strengthening, isn't it? Okay? A good example of a bodhisattva, one who has that mind, is from our lifetime, Mother Teresa. Okay, we don't even have to look in Buddhism for this. This is anybody that has that mind of altruistic motivation to keep others from suffering. And Mother Teresa in our lifetime is probably one of the best examples I could ever give. Okay, Gessler, our teacher, reads anything about Mother Teresa. He loves Mother Teresa and he studies her because she is a true bodhisattva. At the way that we think, or from a Christian viewpoint, that saint. Okay, so it's understanding that, and it takes us off of ourselves. So, and that means that you also take responsibility yourself to do that. So all of a sudden, not only are we thinking of others, but we're going to take that responsibility on. That gives us motivation to keep studying, to keep doing these things, to keep practicing, because when it's about somebody else, we tend to do it. If it's for the benefit of somebody else, we tend to do it. If it's for ourselves, for whatever reason, we don't really take care of ourselves as much, do we? It's kind of a funny thing, but that's the truth. Okay? Work. We even do it at work. We'll kill ourselves at work to take care of clients or take care of other things, even to our detriment. It's the way we tend to do things. And everybody, this is not just our culture. I think the Japanese are even harder on themselves. So, but it's taking responsibility ourselves, and it's a very powerful extension of compassion, and it's a very motivating state of mind, and it brings us to that concept of equanimity. So I talked about that we do this for our children, we do this for our parents, our mothers, our sisters and brothers, cousins and family and friends. Okay, but all of a sudden we're talking about not just them, but people we may not care for, animals and things we may not really have that warm, fuzzy feeling for, to have that same sense of compassion for all. And that meditation that we did on equanimity kind of at least opens that thought process up to you a little bit more. Trying to think, you know what, everybody has that same want and need to be happy and to be free from suffering. And, we tend to make up these stories in our heads, and wouldn't it be just as easy to make up a nicer story? That all they want is to be happy. We don't know what's going on in their lives. I just ran into this again the other day. An acquaintance of mine that has just been really, really busy. Not cold, but just busy. And you just wish, I wish that they would have done this or done that and done what they said they were going to do, all these things. Well, I found that they were having a very serious family crisis. And so, but until you know that, why don't we cut people slack? Why do we tend to go, they're not doing this stuff. I wish they were doing that stuff. We tend to go to the negative because it affects us. It's all about us. It's all about, I've got these deadlines to take care of. But all of a sudden, if we can just have that little bit of compassion, you have no clue what's going on in anybody else's life. In this room, we have no clue what's going on with everybody in this room. There could be somebody right in this room that just got that bad diagnosis. There could be people right here in this room. We don't know. So wouldn't it be nice to treat everybody with a little bit of compassion? Because we have no clue. So that's part of that practice. So trying not to discriminate against people just based on our own likes and dislikes. Now, it certainly doesn't mean that you've got to, you know, go out and hang out with people, hoodlums, robbers, you know, whatever. You still are going to choose not to hang out with people that you don't care for their actions. That is not what I'm saying at all. But just think about it a little bit. And even though if we don't want to hang out with those people, we can still have compassion for them. So it's just broadening that thought process. And it's not selfish to wish to be free from suffering. In fact, you really have to learn how to have true compassion for yourself, truly, before you can help anybody else. It's just like the swimmer, okay? Somebody's drowning in that swimming pool and you jump in and you don't know how to swim? Pretty foolish. So you really need to learn to have compassion for yourself, and there's wonderful meditations on this. And once you understand your own suffering, you really can have a little bit more wisdom and true compassion for others. Again, it's that experiential knowledge. And we just don't tend to do that for ourselves. But if you learn it for yourself, then you can do it better and wiser with others. Make sense? Okay, so tonight we're going to move on to the other wing, which is wisdom. And we're going to get really specific about this because, boy, this is probably one of the most misconstrued concepts in Buddhism, the wisdom of emptiness. Okay, so before we go there, I'm going to remind everybody that if you go to Kadampa Center and then go to spiritual programs, and underneath there I think it's beginner programs, then you'll find Buddhism in a nutshell. Has everybody found those handouts? Okay, is everybody looking at all those? Did you all see that, the foundation of all good qualities? That Buddhist prayer? And maybe you looked at it and maybe you thought, huh, that's a little much. I want to just go over that really briefly so that you have a little bit of a concept of what that actually is. Where did I put that? Okay, the handout number 6 that's on the website. This is called The Foundation of All Good Qualities. And this is a very important Lam Rim prayer, and it relates to the graduated path to enlightenment. And you can kind of use this as what we call a glance meditation. What that means is when you read this, you're going to find the basic Buddhist concepts in here, and you reflect on those teachings that you've heard or read about these. And many of the subjects in here, many of the lines in here, relate to the topics that we have actually done in this class. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and is difficult to find again. We talked about rebirth. We talked about the turtle coming up through the ocean. So many of these concepts that you're going to read in here are concepts that we've discussed in this class. So as you read through this, just think about it. Think about what we talked about in this class. Think about the different ways that we talked about all these different things. And I want to talk about real briefly the first line, the foundation of all good qualities, is the kind and venerable guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon him with great respect. So I want to. We talked a little bit about the spiritual teacher and the difference that Buddhism has in just even the definition of a teacher. Because we hear that word guru. You're going to go out of this class and you're going to go tell somebody you took a class at a Buddhist center and now you're looking for a guru. And they're going to think, oh good, you have now joined a cult. And we got to watch because you're going to be drinking the Kool-Aid. And all of this funny stuff that everybody thinks because of the words that we use and because of the definitions that Westerners have. And the bad press that certain things have gotten, rightfully so. So the word guru actually means heavy with knowledge. And it's the same as lama. Lama or guru mean teacher, mean heavy with spiritual knowledge. In Tibetan Buddhism, and actually in most all of Buddhism, as you're looking for your teacher, if you were serious about this, okay, looking for your spiritual guide, they actually say that you need to study and look at somebody for about 12 years before you decide. Up to 12 years before you decide to take them on as a guru. They have qualifications. You have to look at them and say, is that person qualified? And there, again, Buddhist lists, there's like 10 to 12 qualities right off the top of the bat that they have to have before you should even look at them as your teacher. They have to have, and I'm not going to go through all of these because, again, these, I'm just trying to specify that for a Buddhist guru or lama, it's totally different than how we think of the word teacher. And even as a student, you are going to have qualities that you need to develop before you're going to be qualified to even find a teacher. This goes both ways. It's a completely different relationship. The student-teacher relationship is completely different. And it's a very, very special thing. Geshe Gelug Choda, we list him as our resident teacher here. And he teaches on Sunday, but you will hear him say the words, I'm your Dharma friend. Okay, because he comes from that background where the teacher-student relationship is a very special relationship, and there's a lot of things that go into that relationship. And he knows that most Westerners don't understand that. So he's talking about it as a separate thing. Now, there are many people here that have Geshe-la for a guru, for a teacher. Okay? And there's a lot of people that just look at him as a Dharma friend. He teaches on Sundays, and it's the way that we look at things. Okay, so it's a big difference. So when you see the word guru, don't worry, nobody here is drinking any of the Kool-Aid. Alright, there is a full process going on, and there are specifications and qualities that you need to look at. So it's a big difference. That's again another concept that is totally different from how we think of it in the Western world and how they think about it in pretty much any Buddhism, whether it's here in the West, over in India, or over in Japan. Big difference. Over in India, it's very common to have a guru. I mean, you grow up with a family guru, just like a, you know, family minister. Same thing. I just want to make sure that as you're looking at some of these handouts, you've got the basis and the background to understand kind of what that is. Okay, stay on here. Actually, the next discovering Buddhism module. That's that class on Monday nights. That's that two-year course on Monday nights that goes in 14 different modules. It lasts for 6 weeks on Monday nights. The very next class is the spiritual guide. And so it would be an excellent next step for you guys. Even though that's the fourth class in that two-year series, you can jump in. It just is really more beneficial if you start with the first class and go the 6 weeks, then try, because they go much deeper than what I've been able to do here, okay? So it's really beneficial. We'll talk about this more at the end. I'll give you dates and everything. But the very next class is the spiritual guide, and that's where they'll spend six, you know, 1.5-hour sessions on Monday nights going in very deep detail. So if that's a wonderful next step and it just happens that that's the module, so it's a good one for you guys to look at. Okay, any questions about anything so far? You guys are a quiet group. Okay, wisdom of emptiness. This is thought to be a difficult topic, but like other things that we've discussed, it's not necessarily easy to understand, but it's super interesting. And again, it's kind of like karma. Oh, I'm going to go back to that too. So don't expect to pick this up in the next 20 minutes. All right? I'm hoping to give you just a little glimpse, okay? That's my hope, just to give you a little glimpse of what we mean when we talk about emptiness, okay? Before we go there, who had the karma crest? We were talking about karma last time. So I went and looked something up because I was trying to figure out a good way to do this. Okay, I'm stepping back to karma for a minute. Remember how we talked about karma being your actions, and then we got all lined up on, well, what if you did this and what if you did that, and is that good or and is that bad? And again, karma is the sixth module in Discovering Buddhism, where they take 6 1.5-hour sessions, not 10 minutes, to go really deeper into it. So we talked about the four aspects of karma, the ripening and all that stuff. In any action, and I'm only going to take it down to 3 breakdowns, okay? It goes way deeper, but again, I'm doing high level here. In any action that you do, it can be broken down. That action is broken down into parts. The intention or the motivation, the actual action, the actual doing of it, and then rejoicing in the result. So these three things have to happen in order for that seed to plant, okay? In order for that seed to plant and ripen. In order for you to get that karmic bump, if it's a good thing, or that karmic weight if it's a bad thing. So my intention, let's go down. My intention is to kill somebody. I am purposely going to kill somebody. I'm angry about it. I'm thinking about it. I'm planning it. I go and do it, and now I'm really happy that they're dead. Boom. I've got all of that negative karma on me. Okay, I did all of it. My motivation, I'm going to go and take my mom out to dinner. Her birthday's coming. I'm making all this stuff up now. Her birthday's coming. I want her to have a wonderful night, and I'm just going to do this wonderful thing for her. I'm going to bring her friends along. This great idea of make everybody happy, right? So I've got the good intention, good motivation, take everybody out, make them happy. I actually do it. I take them all out, we have a wonderful time, and then we're all done, and I'm rejoicing that it went perfect. We had a great time. It's wonderful. Everything's good there, right? Good. So, now, I take the same analogy. I'm going to take my mom and her friends out. I have a good intention. I'm going to do all these things. My action, I take them all out. We have a wonderful time. We get done, and oh, there was food poisoning at the restaurant, and somebody gets sick. Okay? So, I'm sorry that that happened. That wasn't my intention. Certainly didn't mean it to happen. You know, I was doing something good, and I'm certainly not going to rejoice in that result, right? So, the karmic seed isn't complete. And again, class number 6 weeks, but to break down, because we were doing all that parsing of what the actions were. If the intention is there, if the motivation is there, if the action, if you actually did the action, completed the action, and then you rejoiced in the result, you're happy about what happened. If any one of these things is not completed, if any one of these things, you have a good intention and something happened, it's not kind of a complete karmic seed, I guess is a good way to put it for now. You're all just looking at me. Questions? Does this help at all? Because we had that big discussion, I think last week, right? So I wanted to just follow up on that. And again, we're just touching. It's having the awareness. Does this help at all? Questions? You guys are tough, man. Just wanted to go make sure I just follow back with people. Okay. Affections, we did all this. Engaging. Passion. Love and compassion. Girl. Next time we do this, I'm going to have a new computer and I'll have PowerPoint. Okay. Emptiness. I like visual aids. So we're going to have a couple of rules about emptiness, okay? So my first rule that we're going to come back to over and over again Emptiness does not mean nothingness. Emptiness does not mean nothingness. That is a probably one of the biggest conceptual issues that Buddhism has. Okay. Visual aid. Bucket, flag, flowers, water bottle, phone, stuff in the bucket, right? I'm going to take the flowers out. Is this bucket empty? Is the bucket empty? No trick question here. No. Stuff in the bucket? Could I say, though, that this bucket is empty of flowers? We don't talk that way, but does that make sense? This bucket is empty of flowers. We don't talk that way in the West. But you understand what I'm saying, right? This bucket is empty of flowers. But is the bucket empty? Emptiness, people. Basic concept, okay? Now, this, again, is one of those things. You're going to study this. If you get into this, you will study this. We all do. This is the big one. This is what we do, is try to glimpse emptiness. I'm going to read from Venerable Amy's book, and then we're going to do some more emptiness concepts. What does the term emptiness mean? According to Tibetan Buddhism, emptiness refers to an absence of inherent existence. What is inherent existence? Inherent existence is a quality we instinctively project onto ourselves and everything we experience. We see things solidly, concretely existing from their own side, in and of themselves, by way of their own nature, independent of causes and conditions, parts, or our own mind experiencing them. Don't worry, we're going to go through this. Our projection of inherent existence is completely unconscious and very subtle. In fact, we don't even think it's a projection at all. We think that when we perceive an object, the object is presenting itself to us and not the other way around. We understand what we're doing. What projecting an inherently existent object means experientially, once we do this, once we kind of get that little glimpse of it, then we're on our way to understanding and realizing what emptiness really means. Things and ourselves do not exist the way they appear. And this is the source of all of our suffering. All right? On some level, we think like our car is going to last, or our relationship, our health, any other object of our experience. And when it doesn't, we suffer. We've often heard the phrase, appearances can be deceiving, and this is certainly the case when it comes to both impermanence and emptiness. We believe what appears to us is existing exactly the way that we see it, as solidly existing for all time, just like that. Then in the next moment, we over-embellish or underestimate that appearance and experience either attachment or aversion to it. This is the way that we view both ourselves and all other phenomena. Our storytelling mind makes up various dramas, and then we suffer. Let's take a look at ourselves. We're made up of a body and a mind. The body is a composition of flesh, muscle, blood, bones, organs, cells. The mind is a continuum of thoughts and feelings, memories, experiences, and other mental activity. On top of the body and the mind, we add a label such as man, woman, American, European, Joe, Mary. Then out of ignorance, the mind invents and grasps onto a fantasized, stable, secure, inherent, independent, permanent self. And that self is a complete hallucination. All of our interactions are tainted by our trust in this hallucination. When someone or something enhances our false sense of image, we're attracted to them. When someone or something harms that self-image, we feel aversion towards them. And this is how attachment and aversion are born from ignorance, how all of the other non-virtuous mental states arise, such as jealousy, pride, depression, anxiety, and fear, just to name a few. All of this comes from fundamental ignorance. And therefore, to have a more realistic approach to life, we must overcome our ignorance about who we are and how we exist. And this will lend itself to lasting happiness because we will no longer be fooled by appearances. So, again, we're just going to touch this. All right? And I'm going to probably try to come at this a couple of different ways. Again, if I can just get you to have just a little bit of a glimpse. The bucket's not empty, but it's empty of flowers. The Buddhist view of how things exist, you can think of that karma is how things operate, okay, and emptiness is how things really exist. So let's get warmed up on some of these things. Now, one of the guys that used to teach this class used an analogy. I'm going to do his little story. And again, I'm going to come at this a few different ways. Suppose I said the word ibu. Does that mean anything to anybody? Ibu. Suppose I said the word mother. All of a sudden now you have whatever that feeling is, that warm fuzzy, if you had a good relationship, but you understand what I'm saying. So now if I say the word ibu, and I told you that that was Indonesian for mother. Now when I say the word ibu, you know, maybe you've got a mental picture of an Indonesian woman with a child. So you all of a sudden put a label on that. All of a sudden you understood what that word meant. Okay, but just a minute ago, that word had no meaning to you whatsoever. So we sit here and we talk and we use words and we act as if these words have inherent meaning. And sometimes we're very shocked when you don't understand what I'm saying. It's like, why don't you understand? I actually heard a gentleman say, I do not understand why you do not understand me. The funniest statement I ever heard. I do not understand why you do not understand me. Everything I say makes perfect sense to me, but we're trying to get the concepts across to you. Everything that I say, I know the concept of what I'm saying. You guys are hearing these words and trying to put labels and concepts to them. If these words had any intrinsic meaning on their own side, from their own side, then the word ibu would make perfect sense to everybody on this planet. The word mother would make perfect sense to anybody on this planet. If those words had their own intrinsic meaning from their own side, that permanent thing, everybody would know what they were. Kind of there? Lift it? Blank. Okay. We mix the label with the thing. We perceive that things exist from their own side. And we're not saying that things don't exist. They do. But just not... Yes, sir?
When you say their own side, what does that mean?
Okay. Here we go. I love this part of this class. The way that self and phenomena exist conventionally is relative and interdependent. They came into existence dependent on causes and conditions, parts, and a labeling mind. Everything, everything exists because of this. Causes and conditions, parts, and a labeling mind. Meaning, we think that things exist from their own side. Is there anything that you can think of? Is there anything that you can think of that exists from its own side that isn't dependent on these things? Is there any permanent existence of anything? Think of anything that exists from its own side. From its own side? Okay. Okay. But this is what is all coming together. Is there anything permanent? Is there anything permanent on this planet that you can think of that's permanent, that exists permanently? Taxes and death, right? Yeah. But death, from a Buddhist perspective, isn't permanent. So that's what we mean. From its own side, meaning it's a permanent fixture, that it exists on its own. Make sense? Kind of? Okay. everything exists because of causes, conditions, parts, and a labeling mind. Okay, what is this? Flower, right? Let's get one. Okay, what have we got? A flower. Tell me when it stops being a flower. Still a flower? Yes, no, maybe? Not a flower. What is it now? It's crumbs. It's petals. It's stems. Okay. So if I brought... So a flower exists because of the parts. Okay. So the parts, these are all the parts. Causes and conditions. Okay. A little seed, a little water, a little sunshine caused it to grow. Parts that I've just destroyed. Okay. And a labeling mind. Okay, we call it a flower. Okay, so we gave it a label, right? Somebody else from another country gave it a label. So it has to have a label for it to... We've labeled it. It's dependent. It is dependent on all of these things. Anything that I pick, this pen, okay? This pen. Parts. Somebody built it, right? All these different parts and parcels, right? The tip, the ink, all these different things. We label this a pen. If it was a pen from its own side, then any sentient mind would see it as a pen, correct? If it was a permanent pen that just existed from its own side, right? Okay, so if I leave this down here and a sentient mind of an ant comes along, are they going to say, oh, look at the pen. Look at that mountain. You know, look at that thing I have to go around. Okay, so if it was permanent, if it existed from its own side, then it would be every sentient mind that would see, it would exist from its inside. It would be permanent. Everything that comes into existence, the second it comes into existence, is already decaying. It's already arising and subsiding. Even your thoughts, they come and they go, don't they? They arise, you think about them, and then they go. This table was built. It was created. And even sitting here, it is disintegrating. And if I left it outside, it would disintegrate faster. Okay, my car. I loved my car when I got my brand new car. Okay, it's now no longer brand new. Now it's got the dents and the dings. So, and it's going to disintegrate, right? Now when I first got it, and it was brand new, and I was so excited about it, I had a lot of attachment to it, and that first ding, don't we all just feel that? Oh, and then we get upset about it. So we tend to look at these things that we have as permanent, and they're going to always be like that. And there isn't a thing that is permanent and is always going to be like that. And that's why we suffer, whether it's a car, whether it's a relationship, that's what happens. Am I kind of there? Am I close? Getting it a little bit? So, emptiness does not mean nothingness, but it means that things don't exist the way we see them. We tend to put wrappers on everything. Okay, so it's kind of like... It is. It's like putting a wrapper on things. The granddaddy of all illusions is how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as existing independently. Sandy is sitting here. Okay? I got a collection of blood parts, skin and bones You know, where's Sandy? Just like, I mean, I could literally take Sandy and rip her apart, just like I did that flower. I've got bones, I've got blood. Where's that inherent Sandy-ness here? I came into existence. Causes and conditions. My mom and dad got together 50-something odd years ago. All right, causes and conditions for being here. Parts, all my different parts, my skin, my bones, the brown hair, a labeling mind. You all are labeling me Sandy. You label me Sandy. I told you that label. But you know what? I could go out to the other room, have people in sitting in there, and I could say my name is Betty. So that's just a label. Okay, I seem very real to me. To me, I feel like I'm independently existing. And this is a very real phenomenon that I think is not just a concept, but we place this wrapping paper over it. Think about the labels that we put on people. Man, woman, Sandy, George, American, you know, short, tall, fat, skinny, white, black, you know, smart, dumb. The good labels and the bad labels. They're all labels, the way that we think about each other. We label all the time. And we're labeling because of our perceptions. We're labeling because of what we do. Every single one of you, I could have you sit down and write a paragraph about me, and it would all be different. Some of you maybe really like me. Some of you maybe think I talk too much. Some of you think I, you know, my voice is squeaky. Some of you like my voice. It's all empty. Because you all have different perceptions of it. So who is that Sandy? Okay, we place this conventional base. We lay this wrapper over the top, and the wrapper is the illusion, okay? The problem is that we perceive this every day, and we see this as coming from that object, and we don't see the wrapper as a wrapper. We put the whole thing together. And so how do things really exist? Dependently and changing from moment to moment. Everything is dependent, and everything changes from moment to moment. From the moment something comes into existence, it is impermanent, and it is arising, and it is subsiding. Even, like I said, even our thoughts arise and subside. Now, you guys are the quiet class. Any questions about this?
Think like a musical note. There's mm-hmm. like you play a C.
Yep.
If you play three C's in a row, they're not all the same. They're not all the same. Each C has either a C preceding it or a C after it, or mm-hmm. is the third in a line. Or, you know, like if you play a D, a C, a G, the C is changed by the note before it and the note after it. So like doesn't exist as a C itself, you know.
Oh, I see what you're doing. Because your awareness of it being a C is because it had a...
this relationship to before and after.
My husband's a musician. That's why I followed his thought. Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. And the reason that, you know, we labeled it a C, and just the music, the sound itself, you know, whether it's a guitar, a piano, or something, the strum, so it happened, the music swells, and then subsides. Everything does that. So... one of the ways that I try to work with people to understand when we say that, you know, that people are impermanent in a way is, are you the same person sitting here now that you were maybe 10 years ago? Exactly. All right, do you think you're going to be the same person 5 years from now? No, we're changing. We're changing all the time. It's part of it. But it, what makes it empty is when I say that, okay, because it doesn't mean nothingness. It just means that all the things that we are putting on it are not really there. You're not seeing it the way it really is. Okay, so my friend and I go to a meeting, and we have this meeting with a vendor, let's just say. Okay, so Sandy and Susie go to meet Bob, and we have... the same meeting, we're in the same meeting, and we get out of that meeting, and I say, boy, I really didn't like Bob. He was you know, grouchy, not happy, da-da-da-da-da-da. And Susie says, oh, I really liked him. He seemed, you know, he was very cut to the dry, whatever, got the points across. So she likes him. I don't, we have the same view. Okay, we met the same man, but we have different perceptions. So we put these things on there based on what, based on basically our karma, okay, that projection that we're doing, and we're meeting the same person, and he's saying the same things, he's got the same look, but our karma each has us seeing something else. And so if we can learn to kind of step back and be aware of that labeling mind, be aware of the things that we are putting on those people, we have a better glimpse of being a little bit, seeing reality, okay? And that's not just with people, it's with things. You have a question?
I was following you, and I am following you. I get the whole idea of labeling causes, parts, all of that stuff. Nothing's irreducible. Though there are things that aren't, like gravity. You probably, that fits out, that falls but, outside of that.
Yeah, that's a concept. So it will arise and fall. So, yeah, further. That one, I'm not going to touch that one, because that'll go deep. Go to the class. Six weeks.
What I'm not clear on is how the labeling thing, and I think we do that strictly for communication, we...
I wish that that was all it was, because then it would be a kinder, gentler word, if it was all just for communication purposes.
Communication between people,
right,
or even within ourselves.
Yeah, I wish.
Okay. What I don't get is how the dependency arising non-permanence equates, how that relates to the wisdom of emptiness. How do you tie them together? That's the part that I somehow miss.
Okay, if we understand emptiness, if we truly understand the wisdom of emptiness, and if we have that ability to see things as they really truly exist, if we understand how things really truly exist, then we'd understand everything. Because we have to understand how things truly exist and able to be able to work with it better, to understand it better, to be able to see things better, to be happier, to help others to be happier. Because we don't truly understand emptiness. We're all working on it. Like I said, we're just touching. This is something that people take years, and I'm just trying to get the glimpses. Okay, so ask your question again. How does that tie into... If you understand emptiness, if you understand those three things on that path.
All right, look.
Okay.
So let's.
It's okay. Go for it. This is good. No. I do too.
Emptiness. And what I think I just heard was that if I recognize that things are made up of their pieces and parts and I've labeled them somehow and all that. Let's say that's all true.
Okay.
How is that emptiness? That's the part I don't get. Forget the flowers. Anything. How is my recognition of...
How is your recognition of how things exist help you?
How is that emptiness?
Okay. Well, number one, emptiness is a label. So let's go there right off the bat. Okay. What we're trying to say is that let's take it to the opposite effect. Let's look at the things that we do, because I heard you say that we pretty much label for communication purposes. I'm into communication, so I love this one. Okay, right? So we label things in order to communicate and talk to each other, right?
Or
to ourselves, okay? And that's true to some extent, okay? That's very true to some extent. Now take it to how your mind is labeling, okay? Take it to how your mind is labeling things, not for communications, but for yourself. I'm trying to come up with a good analogy that won't take us too far off track. Okay, so again, I'm going to go into the people thing. I really like this person. And you put all these labels on people. You put labels on everybody in this room without even thinking about people you like, people you don't like, strangers, people that you find an affinity with or that you're kind of drawn to. We make those judgments. We make judgments on the things that we like or don't like. And if we could understand that those judgments are a wrapper that we're putting on things, instead, because it just doesn't, it's not real. So I'm trying to go to the other side of it, rather than trying to take you through the emptiness side of it. I'm trying to come at it from the things that we can take off the wrappers. Okay? So if you can start to take off these things that we put on people, and not just for how we talk to ourselves or how we talk to our things, but the liking and not liking. Am I making it all sense? Okay, but I understand what it's like trying to get your mind around something. How is that empty? Because the labels aren't there. So it's not, it's just, it's like we're throwing this projection from our karma up on the screen, but it's not real. It's a projection. And that's a good analogy that Venerable Rubina uses all the time. Yes?
The way I thought of it was like, and again, I'm not getting into anyone's political business, but you got President Obama. And that's all I've said. And if I stop my mind there, I got a better chance of hearing what the guy has to say than if my mind is saying, like, oh, Obamacare, or, you know, doesn't handle Iraq right. I put all these labels on him, too liberal, too this. If I just stop it and I'm aware of that, my filters are more open. And it's kind of like an empty, and I can move a little freer in understanding what someone's saying.
Yeah, that is a good first. That is part of it. Okay, having that, go ahead. We've got another one here.
Like when I was a kid and I saw some kid and I thought that kid was cool, I built up this perception of who they were. And then, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I found out differently, but my perception of them did not make them what they are. I mean, it wasn't like...
Right, we're putting these perceptions on everything. Okay, so we're talking on some high-level things here. Okay, it's going to go way, way deeper when you get into this. But this is excellent because this is the first step of that.
So if we're human...
Mm-hmm.
We have a mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's in our nature to label.
Yes.
So is the wisdom of, I can see the wisdom of emptiness, and I hear what you're saying and you're saying, is emptiness attainable really for a human, given that the way our minds work?
Yes, because that's Buddhahood. And if we have that wisdom, if we truly understand, and actually it's possible to reach a level of understanding emptiness and having what they call calm abiding as a human. And some of these well-studied monks, okay, that have been practicing, they get it. Okay, so you don't have to be a Buddha. You can get there. And once you're studying a little bit, you'll start to get a little bit more. It's just like typing class. Okay, it's just like typing class. You guys remember, we're all kind of, there's some younger ones in here. When you first go in and they give you that thing and they said A, B, and you had to do this, you thought, there's no way I'm ever going to do this without looking at the keys. Do you remember that? There's no way. And all of a sudden you can do it because it's practice.
Wouldn't it be hard for people, because like, for instance, you, and I don't mean to pick on you.
No, pick on me.
You said,
it's easier.
You're a quiet class.
You guys are.
A quiet class. Well, that was a label.
Absolutely, it was a label. I do it all the time.
So I'm thinking that for most people,
yeah.
This has got to be super hard to attain.
It is. It's very hard. It's not hard to attain. It's doable. Anything worthwhile. Okay? Yes, we do. I label all the time. We all do. Okay? But it's having that awareness that we're doing it and then having it like, wow, look at me. Okay? I'm doing it. But it's, the trick is, ever tell you about the time I took the bodhicitta test? Okay, this will tell you. So, I took Discovering Buddhism, I took the 2-year course, and I took it for certification, okay? And I was one of the few that was taking it in this whole 2-year period. And in a particular class, when we were talking, that 6-week course, on bodhicitta, okay, I was the only one in the class that took the test. So not only a little pride there, right? Well, I'm the only one that's doing this, all right? Feeling pretty good, aced it, 100%. Got my little smiley face and feeling all good about bodhicitta, that altruistic, okay, love and compassion. We're talking bodhicitta here. And I go home that night, and I'm talking with my husband about an upcoming event that we're going to have. And we have to invite all of these people. And I have to invite somebody that I don't particularly care for. And I go into, right? I'm all of a sudden, I'm talking, and, oh, why do we have to invite her? You know, it's going to make it no fun that night. I'm going on and on. And all of a sudden, I just was shocked. I almost burst into tears. It was like, Miss Bodhicitta, look at you. And it was 2 hours. It was 2 hours from this center and passing this test to going home and going, I don't want to invite her. I was really devastated. I was actually quite upset about it. I'm joking about it now. I was really upset. I was very upset. Because it was not even 2 hours, and I had fallen right back into that mind, that negative mind, just like that. And I came the next day, and I'm talking with the teacher, okay, who happened to be Sangha, okay? And I was really upset, and she said, Sandy, you are totally missing the point here. The point is that it took you 2 hours, and you caught it. 2 hours. It wasn't 5 hours, it wasn't 5 days, it wasn't never catching it. You caught it in 2 hours. And guess what? You're going to catch it faster next time. Yes.
You're talking about the party and the person you're invited. I'm not understanding. It's not inherent to the act of labeling that. It's a negative, non-virtuous concept. I mean, if I invite a known felon, dangerous person to my party, somebody's going to get hurt.
Right.
That's
and
not
I'm,
me.
Oh,
I labeled him, and now I'm
not being... labeling is not a negative.
Right. So
correct.
I'm not connecting
okay.
labeling to suffering.
Okay. So what is negative is when we... put labels on people that truly aren't. I mean, let's just talk reality here. You know, we sometimes choose people that we like or don't like, and we don't even really know them. Okay, that can be the negative, but I'm talking to, that's just very basic, you know, rudimentary, be nice, right? That's not even, we don't even have to go deep into karma or anything like that. Being Buddhist does not mean you're a doormat. It does not mean that you have to invite killers over to your house. It does not mean that you have to do any of that. It doesn't mean that you're negative by not doing that. Period. So there's no negativity by labeling. That's not where I'm going.
How do you decide what's negative and not negative?
Well, now, so let's go back to those lists. Okay? Jealousy. Negative. I mean, some of this stuff, again, this is just that common sense. We don't have to get all spiritual. Hurting somebody, body, speech, and mind, remember those things? It's a very simple, very secular list, right? Those are the negative things, the very simple list. Okay, killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, harsh speech, divisive speech, gossip, covetousness, anger, and wrong view. I think pretty much a Buddhist, a Catholic, a Jew, a Muslim, right? I don't think you have to even have a religion to think that those are, okay? This is very pretty non-secular, right? Or secular, I would say, right? Doesn't matter. Can everybody agree that these are pretty much negatives? So that's actually quite easy. Labeling is not negative, okay? Labeling something is not negative. That's not what I'm saying at all. to try to see things as they really exist is what we're trying to do. That isn't, that this isn't about virtue and non-virtue. It's just trying to really understand how things actually exist. And the fact that we tend to put all of these labels on things based on our karma and our perception. And we could put something in the middle of the room and have everybody in here look at it, and we're all going to have something totally different based on our perception or our karma. And so how do things really exist? Is it the way we see it? Probably not, because we each have a different view of it. Wow. Guys, it's 8:30. So sorry. I wasn't watching the time. Okay, so let's do this real quick. First, what's next? Discovering Buddhism, that two-year course, all right, it is that two-year course, but you are free to go in and take that at any time. You don't have to wait for it to come around again. It's going into its fourth module, and it's starting June 1st. And this module is relating to the spiritual teacher. And so it's a good one to take. Karma is the sixth module. And sometimes they don't go quite right in order. It depends on the teacher's availability, because we have different people able to teach these courses. So karma's coming up. So you guys all should go into that class, because not depending on who's teaching it, but there's a couple that I really, really love that you will find so much better at explaining these things than I am. Okay, because they have the time and they can go into really deep. Like I said, they've got 6 1.5-hour sessions to talk only about karma. All right. Another thing, you guys have the good karma to Venerable Amy Miller, the author of this book, is coming here. She's going to be here June 26th through the 28th. So the 26th, I think that's a Friday. She'll have some kind of a 2-hour class, I think probably 2.5 hours. So this particular visit, I'm going to just read, this is what they're putting out about this. When negative mind states such as stress, anxiety, depression, anger, or jealousy get engaged, how do we stop the dysfunction, looping, and maintaining a healthy presence? The dysfunctional looping and maintain a healthy presence. This weekend program will explore a deeper understanding of what happens, offer techniques to interrupt unhealthy habits, and introduce meditations that can guide us to a more balanced reality. Tonglen and loving kindness meditation will be included. My favorite meditation, Tonglen. T-O-N-G-L-E-N. Tonglen. My favorite. Will be included. All events are open to anyone, and there's no pre-registration, and there's no fees. Everything that we do is based on generosity. So, Venerable Amy Miller, if you guys have the opportunity, she's the lady who wrote this. She's phenomenal. And again, there won't be any fees. So how can you beat that? It's all based, everything that we do here on the center is based on generosity. We don't charge fees for anything. And we're able to keep the lights on, pay for air conditioning, pay the mortgage and everything, just literally based on the generosity of our members and the people that come to these classes. So if any of this has been a benefit to you, please, there's donation boxes on the way out. Feel free. Most all of us are volunteers here. I did also check Meditation 101 isn't scheduled yet. That's usually the class that just bounces, you know, it's Meditation 101, Buddhism in a Nutshell, Meditation 101. And I did check on the schedule, and right now it looks like we're going to be taking a little bit of a break. Please check the website often, and you can get on, we do have a Yahoo announcement list that you can get on. If you go to the website, on the Contact Us page, I believe there's an area that you can click on. It will take you over to the Yahoo group to sign up. So you have to do it. It's not, we'll get there where we have constant contact and that kind of thing. But right now, yes, sir.
When you come here on Sunday, some people prostrate.
Yes.
Is that to the Buddha? On Sunday when... people
yep.
Do prostrations at the beginning of services. Is that to the
Geshe Gelug or to the Buddha or the Dharma?
I love that question. I'll explain that one. Here's what I'm going to do.
Cause offense if I do it. I don't really know what I'm doing.
I'll explain. Here's what I'm going to do. Anybody that wants to go, it's 8:30. Okay. Thank you all for coming. And you're welcome to hang around because I'm going to answer some questions because people have these kind of things. So I'll stay. If you guys want to stay and ask questions, stay. If you need to go, then feel free at any time. So I'm just kind of freeing everybody up and dedicate your efforts for this class. I appreciate everybody coming. You put a lot of time in, and thanks for your patience. Prostrations. So I remember back in the day. It was like prostrations. I had that whole American thing. You know, I don't bow down to anybody. You remember that thing? What is that? Pride. Okay? So that is actually one of the, you know, eight deadly sins, whatever you want to call it. Okay? So humbling yourself before the teachings. Humbling yourself before the teachings. We're not bowing to the Buddha. We're not bowing before false gods. We're humbling ourselves to the teachings and to that teacher who actually knows so much more, showing respect. It is actually it's a cultural. Taking our shoes off is cultural. It's just a sign of respect. So when we prostrate, it's actually, and I do prostrations, okay? And this is, like I said, I have that whole American attitude, you know, bowing to the king and all that stuff. No, but when you actually put it into practice and you think about what you're doing, you're humbling yourself to the teachings, and you're humbling yourself to that teacher who knows so much more. And it is a wonderful antidote to pride. And so when people bow, when the teacher walks in, or when you first come in to the Gampa, because that is that representation of the Buddha, and that's a representation of the Buddha, okay? Now imagine, think about it this way, if that was really the Buddha, or if the Dalai Lama was really here, all of a sudden if you think about it like that, it becomes a different awareness, doesn't it? So what we do is we put our hands together. And normally when you do this, you'll see people tucking their thumbs in so that their hands are not offering anything empty. Okay? And they touch the crown, they touch the forehead, throat, and heart. Okay, now everybody's got their own kind of little things. But for me, it's I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha with my body, my speech, and my mind. And then you prostrate. Some people will do full prostrations, some people will do half prostrations, some people will just bow. And some of that's because of physical, okay? I'm an old lady with a bum knee. I'm not going to, you know, it's kind of difficult for me to get down and get back up sometimes. But all of this is in your mind. It's about your mind. Geshe-la prefers that when we do prostrations, you'll see when, like, the Dalai Lama comes or any big teacher comes, they wait for the teacher to come in and do their prostrations because they do their prostrations because the Buddha, their teachers, have more knowledge than them. They're bowing to the teachings. And then they go, and then people do the prostrations, and Geshe-la prefers that we prostrate with him, because again, he's trying to avoid. So you'll see people doing prostrations. You are more than welcome to do prostrations anytime you want to. I know exactly what you're talking about. Back in church, when do you go up for communion? I don't know what they're saying. I don't know what they're doing. You don't know what to do. And it has that feeling of uncomfortable. It's, you know, so you are free to do anything. This is a very open group. You can ask, what are you doing? What are you doing? How are you doing that? What page are you on? People talk here. We look at this, the Sunday teachings as teachings. Okay, you'll see people with notebooks. You'll see people study. This is a class. This is all class to us. This is more like a college than a church, if you want the analogy of that. Okay, so you are more than welcome to, you don't have to, this, you know, you don't have to have the special permission to do prostrations. You don't have to have special, you don't have to have special permission to do anything. You're working with your mind. About the only time that you would ever run into anything like that is when you get into more ritual work. Okay, in order to do some of the actual rituals, there will be prerequisites for some of those things. But other than that, you know, ask. I know exactly what you're saying. But think about it. Everything that we do, there's a reason for it, and usually a very practical reason. And prostrations is an antidote for pride. Any other questions like that? Does any? It feels wide open right now. Okay, membership in the Kadampa Center is free. We do not have. I used to be the membership coordinator here. We don't charge dues. We don't charge anything. Being a member here actually means that you're part of the family, that the center can count on you, and that you can count on the center. We're not looking to get a lot of people on the rolls and have a ton of people. We're looking for people that are actively engaged and are going to support the center because it is our center. All right? And we do the dishes, we help the teachings, we volunteer with different things, and the only thing being a member will actually get you is the opportunity to chair a position and be on the board. You know, we're looking for people to be engaged, so it's not, you don't, they used to have it where if you were a member you got deals at the bookstore or something like that. We just decided, you know what, we want it to be about being part of a family and being a part. So you can be a member. Membership orientations take place on the second Sunday after the teachings of every month. Kim Lillick is our membership coordinator now, phenomenal woman. And you can volunteer. You don't have to be a member. You can volunteer for anything. If what membership does get you, there is one little benefit right now. We are creating a more robust website, and we have a members area of our website where we're starting to be able to, like, that's where a lot of the teachings reside. We don't have those open to everybody because too many times things can be taken out of context. So we have our teachings, like this class. This is audio recording, which cracks me up because I won't go listen to myself. There's no way. But there's an audio recording back in the members-only area, so if you did want to join, you could go back there, and then you can go back and listen to some of the other teachers of Buddhism in a nutshell. They may have explained things a little bit better sometimes. Okay? Any other? Like I said, it's wide open right now. Yes? Talk us.
So, one of these.
Okay.
Is a representation of the first Buddha.
Yes.
I suppose it's this one.
Yes.
Okay. I get that.
Okay.
Are other ones Buddhas?
Yes.
Okay.
They all are.
That's not my question.
Okay.
Okay. I get the first Buddha.
Okay.
When he's gone, somebody else reaches enlightenment and they're considered a Buddha. Who makes that declaration that they have?
Oh, guess what? There, we all could be Buddhas. Okay? So we have many Buddhas. We have Manjushri is the Buddha that will be coming. No. I'm going to get my names mixed up, so give me a minute. There are many Buddhas. So we have Shakyamuni Buddha. We have the Medicine Buddha. We have Tara, who's the female Buddha of Compassion. We have Chenrezig. Over here, this picture up here on the top. Thousand-armed Chenrezig. Okay? The Buddha of Compassion.
Was he a person?
No. But, well, let me rephrase that. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so not all these... Okay, so there are stories. Shakyamuni Buddha was a person.
Right, so I guess
okay.
So the rest of them, the ones who are not...
So technically, the Dalai Lama is Chenrezig. Okay? He is compassion. Now this is where we're going to get a little bit too deep. I'm going to have you go to the other classes before because I'm going to say things that I probably shouldn't. But... The emanations, okay, so again, these, think of these kind of like PowerPoints. These are lessons, these are teachings. These tantras are ways to teach. This is art form that was started thousands of years ago, and it is a lesson, okay? It's just like sand mandalas are a lesson. That's a teaching. Everything has meaning. So Chenrezig, as the Buddha of Compassion, the story goes that Chenrezig was looking at the world and saw so much need that he literally broke into pieces. And that's how he became the thousand-armed Chenrezig, so that he could do more. So what a beautiful story about compassion. Okay? The tear from Chenrezig fell, and that's how Tara was born, the female Buddha of compassion and love in action. All of the Taras you see, right stretch foot to leap out, to do something. And she is a female Buddha. And the lesson there is she's going to stay and reincarnate as a female because the female is considered a lesser. Okay, just even in these historical things. I know. So this is, now we're going to get into the stories of things. And there's so much. Every single one. Here's Thousand Arm Chenrezig again, Tara. White Tara, green Tara. Everything has a meaning. The colors have a meaning. Every single one of these perflex, the color has a meaning. So it's a way to study. So those who study and meditate on Tara are studying about love in action. So it's all a lesson for our own benefit. You know, if you see somebody, you can put Mother Teresa up on that altar. Same thing. Who do you admire and who are you going to relate to? Same thing. So, yes, there are many, many Buddhas.
Okay, so just to get back to my original question.
Who chooses? It doesn't work that way.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out. When some, I get the first.
And there was, and again, this is where I'm going to have you go to the classes because I'm going to get you all off track and get real confused here real quick because there were Buddhas before. Shakyamuni.
Okay.
And
there may be some living Buddhas today.
Yes.
Who chooses? Who says they're a Buddha versus... So
here's my thing. Nobody is going to say they're a Buddha. For all I know, you all can be Buddhas. You all could be Buddhas here for my benefit. Nobody says, and nobody chooses, you become enlightened. And believe me, most of those people that are, if you think about it, you think about Gashla, you think about the Dalai Lama, you think about any of those high up lamas, they don't sit here and say, I'm enlightened, or I am such a great monk, or I am so good. They don't. The people, those monks and those teachers that are way up, Venerable Amy, she's probably one of the most well-studied Western. She's not going to tell you this stuff. They don't say those things. Yes, sir?
It's not like a college degree. And you are sanctioned.
Not for Buddhahood, no. But there is for the monks and initiations and things like that. Like Geshe-la, Geshe is a title, just like doctor, okay? And not only is Geshe a Geshe, Geshe-la is a Larampa Geshe, so he's like a summa cum laude. So in monastic studies, there is exactly that hierarchical teaching, you know, doctorates, that type of thing. But in an enlightenment sense, no. And they're not going to talk about it. In fact, that's one of the things that's actually part of it, is that you don't. You don't talk about how much you've attained. It's not about everybody else. It's about you. I think it works different ways. So this is that path. And different people, so there are the stories out there of different people reaching enlightenment different ways. Some people have gone through, these are the stories, so some people have gone through all of these paths and reached it, and some people all of a sudden got it when they were mopping the floors at a monastery. So these are all of those stories. So this is part of it. And it is about you and your mind. So you're working on it, you're figuring it out, and only you can do that. And
recognizing that we, based upon what they're teaching, that yes, that we recognize they have something to teach.
Right. Right. And this is for their benefit. All these offerings and things are not for them. They're for us. None of this stuff is for them. Geshe-la, all of these monks, the Dalai Lama, any of them, are the most humble things. They don't. It's not for them. It's how are we working with our minds. All of these things that we do are for our minds.
How did they know they've reached enlightenment? I mean,
I'm pretty sure if they've
yeah. You can't declare somebody's enlightened.
but yeah. somebody perceives that they've reached enlightenment. Yeah, they're not going to say they did, but how do they know they did?
I'm assuming that they know. Okay, because I would pretty much think if they achieve all of these things, I know just from my working on my own mind how far I need to work. But I can also tell when I have reached another level. And I can also very much tell that I've had a glimpse of some of this stuff. And that's, once you have that glimpse, it's like I want more. Okay, so just to even have that little bit of an awareness, then all of a sudden that's what kind of keeps you going back. So you're asking one of these ethereal questions of how are you going to know? Well, if you become enlightened, then I would assume that you would know. And if you question it, then you probably haven't.
It does seem like you talk about how you can't work out of your mind.
Oh, it's tough.
I don't think it's not an issue of like listening to the Buddha enough.
No.
You've got to do it yourself.
That's right. That's right.
He can get you on the path, but...
That's right, because he's not a god. He can't just...
Like,
yep.
Enlighten me,
nope.
I could sit and talk with him forever. I've got to...
Yep, you have to do the work.
I got it.
And you know what? And it may be easier for you than it is for me. Your mind, you know, because of all the karma, all of the things, again, all these things that you've got, you just may have a mind that understands things quicker. Because we all are different.